Well, hello everybody, and thank you for joining me again today on my Born to Talk radio show podcast. I'm so happy to have you joining me. My guest today is Frederick Fisher. He is the president of Fisher Consulting Group, and he's also the author of Claims Made Insurance, the policy that changed the industry. Welcome to the show, Frederick.
Oh, welcome, and thank you for such a warm welcome. It's a pleasure to be here with you, Marcia.
Well, thank you. And you know, moving forward, I'm going to consider you my friend. If you don't mind, I'm going to call you Fred. Is that all right with you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Perfect.
We are friends.
We are friends. So I always like to talk to my guests ahead of time, just for those of you that are listening. And I've gotten to know Fred pretty well, and I'm really interested in having him share with you his expertise. And before we get to that, I always like to know just a little bit about my guests ahead of time. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself, Fred?
Well, I know I'm supposed to tell you where I grew up, but I'm not going to admit I did. But
are you not grown up yet?
No, I'm not going to admit that. But I was raised in Michigan originally, and I went to grammar school and most of high school there, then went to finished up high school in Santa Barbara. And then I went to UC Berkeley in the 60s, which is a story in and of itself. Ended up in law school in San Francisco, and one thing led to another, and all of a sudden I found myself not doing what I thought I was going to do, which was doing musician and artist representation, but I ended up in what's called the professional liability insurance industry, for which I immediately got hooked on and became very passionate about. And originally as a claim adjuster, handling professional liability claims against lawyers and accountants and architects and engineers and insurance agents and brokers and real estate agents and brokers, what have you, and did that for 20 years. And then after that, I got kind of tired of claims and claim auditing. We were doing that and got involved in risk management consulting and software development and a bunch of stuff. But ultimately, I ended up on the supply side, or I became what's called a wholesale insurance broker, where I wasn't necessarily dealing with the consumer directly. I was working with the consumer's representative, their agent or broker, as it were, and have developed quite an expertise in that as well. But at the time, in 1994, there were very few specialists in the field, and I was one of them. And so the agency just exploded. But the policies and the coverages that we were providing to lawyers and accountants and architects and any oddball consultants of all kinds, those types of insurance policies are complex, they're dangerous, they're full of what I called gotchas that'll get you, and you really got on the top of your toes. And so here I am almost 50 years later, or actually over 50 years later, and the policies have gotten trickier and trickier and trickier, which is one of the reasons why I wrote the book. Almost all these policies for professionals are written on a claims-made basis, and they're potentially very dangerous. So in any event, that's how I got into it, and that gives you a shorthand version of my 50 years.
I would assume after 50 years of being in this world, you must have seen it all. Is that why you wrote Claims Made Insurance, the policy that changed the industry?
Well, that was part of it. But as I mentioned, these policies are filled with gotchas, and they're very dangerous. And a good example of that is some of the statistics we derived. You know, for instance, these policies require that you report a claim against you when somebody's making a lawsuit against you or threatening you with a lawsuit. You've got a time limit by which you have to report that claim to the insurance company. And it has to be usually within the policy term, as well as, you know, some other factors. The problem was, statistically, guess who had the highest percentage of claims being denied for either not reporting the claim on time or not disclosing that you're aware that there is a problem and the application you're signing says, are you aware of any problem? And you say no. And believe it or not, 28% out of 224 appellate decisions I looked at were from law firms. They were the worst. They had the highest percentage of claims being denied. So if there's anybody that needs to read my book, it's lawyers.
I guess so. So why do you think this is so important?
Well, overall, the insurance industry has changed dramatically, and not necessarily for the better. And we've all grown up with the concept that insurance companies are always looking to deny claims. And whether that's true or not, since from 1970, say, through 2000, 2005, we can debate that. But since that time, it now is becoming more increasingly clear that that is in fact the case, that the drive for profit, 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 profit at any cost means that the policies are intentionally now being written in such a way that are giving rise to appropriate denials of coverage, or legally appropriate denials of coverage, where normally those types of claims used to be paid. We're not even talking gray areas. And that is a major concern to me. And, you know, that's one of another reason I wrote my book, was to say, hey, here's one policy that's very complicated, and here's what you need to know so you don't have claims denied. But my next book is going to be called The Gotchas That'll Get You, and that's going to look at homeowners and auto insurance and commercial casualty. It's going to look at the whole spectrum of how these policies are written, what you need to know so you don't have a claim denied. And ultimately, it may hopefully spark legislative intervention. I mean, you know, you've got an organization out there called the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. Their mission statement is to see and regulate insurance companies, and they're dropping the ball every day.
Interesting. Huh. You know, let's go through some definitions, because I always find that that's helpful to me. If I don't know, perhaps our listeners may not know as well, and that is, could you tell me the difference between an agent and a broker?
Oh, boy. I don't want to kill the whole hour on it, but I'll give you as good an answer as I can. There you go. Exactly. First of all, they're very abused phrases. He's my agent. This person's my agent. That person's my agent. That person's my broker. That's all well and good. In reality, in some states, in California being one of them, agent and broker are statutorily defined, and there's a process by which it's done legally. For instance, an agent has to be appointed by an admitted insurance company, admitted to do business in a given state. And there's a process by which an insurance company does that. They do it now. They can do it online. But they're notifying the Department of Insurance that Joe Smith, or even an entity like Joe Smith Inc. or Joe Smith and Partners or whatever, they're now agents of this insurance company. And from there, it can get really complicated, because there are three different models. The first model is 100% captive. You can only write business with that insurance company, or that insurance company and affiliated companies in their family, but you can't write with another company. And there's plenty of captive agents, Allstate being one of them, for instance.
Okay.
State Farm agents, again, they can only place business with State Farm. They, by contract, are not allowed to do business with any other insurance company that's outside the State Farm family. But now let's look at Farmers agents. They are not captive. If they're properly licensed, number one, they have to give first right of refusal to Farmers. And if Farmers says, no, we don't want this account, then they're free to go anywhere they want if they have the proper license, and that, again, can vary from state to state. A broker, on the other hand, doesn't represent the insurance company. They represent you. And there's a lot of insurance companies a broker can do business with where they are not required to appoint you as an agent, or appoint the broker as an agent and what have you. Some states allow that to happen, or where they are appointed but they're still representing you. Or in California, for instance, they can be an appointed agent of an insurance company. They can still represent you by going to other insurance companies if they have the ability to do that. It's what's called an independent agent. They can do business with many companies. They're appointed by many companies as the agent, and they can still go to other insurance companies as your broker, representing you. And so they're your representative. The problem are the obligations, and that can get kind of gnarly.
I
think that's the best way of explaining it. But it can be statutory, and then you got the colloquial use, which is not statutory and unfortunately grossly abused.
So just as a side note, we've had all these terrific, horrific fires here, and people have homeowners insurance. Do they work with an agent, or do they work with a broker if they have State Farm?
Well, if it's State Farm in California, for instance, State Farm, again, appoints individuals and business entities as their agent of State Farm. So they are technically an agent of State Farm Insurance Company on everything, because they're not allowed to go to any other insurance company with the exception of going to Assigned Risk for Auto or they can refer you to the Fair Plan for property insurance. And that's it. So they are not, they are a representative of the insurance company. They are not representing you. Now, that doesn't give them, that doesn't mean that they can lie to you or misrepresent coverage to you. But on the same token, they have no duty to advise you at all in California.
Interesting. So how does any consumer, whether it's personal or business, get what they need then?
Well,
that's a $100,000.
There you go. That's not even a $64,000 question. You could multiply that by another 1,000, probably the $64 million question.
Really?
Oh my God! The problem is that in Cal, it all started with a lawsuit involving by the name of Jones versus Grew, GREWE for anybody who wants to look it up. But it all started with that, and I think it was in the late 1980s. And that was a case where somebody said, "Oh, my agent didn't get me enough insurance. I don't have enough fire limits on my home." And the California court ruled there's no duty to do that. There is no duty for an agent to advise the insured as to limits at all. And unfortunately, that case exploded. And so now you've got 37 states that now follow what's called the order taker standard of care. That may sound legalese, and to some extent it is, but what that means is they don't have any duty to advise you at all. They have none. Their job is to diligently obtain the question or the coverage you ask for, as if you know more about it than they do. But here's the problem with that. That's like going to your doctor, and he said, "Well, Marcia, I see you're walking very well today. How would you like me to? What do you think is wrong with you, and how would you like me to treat you?"
Like I'm the expert, right?
Exactly. That's the analogy.
Wow.
And 37 states follow that. So do it in reverse order. I know you've got a national audience, and I compliment you for that. So here are the 13 states that don't follow that. Arizona, Connecticut, Florida, Georgia, Hawaii, Idaho, Michigan, Montana, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Washington, D.C., and West Virginia. And of all those 13, only two hold insurance producers, because most states license people as producers. And they may or may not distinguish between agent and broker. And again, that's state specific. The bottom line is only New Jersey and, to my knowledge, Florida hold an insurance producer to the highest standard of care, commonly referred to as a fiduciary standard. And of those two, only New Jersey has codified it by statute. Florida did it by case law and common law decisions. And the other states have a mass variety. They look at the totality of circumstances, what's going on in the relationship, how long have they done business with you, that sort of thing. And so that all becomes a question of fact. But the bottom line is, that's only 13 states where they have that standard. The other 37 basically hold, you're on your own. You have to know more about the insurance than, you know, the person who's selling it to you, even though they're probably experts over a period of time. They know what the ins and outs are. So to answer your question, you have to really be somewhat aggressive in a, you know, nice way of being specific with your agent or with the person you're doing business with who's going to try and get you coverage. And be specific as to what your needs are. And you just can't say, "I want to be covered for everything." That's far too vague and far too general to have any, you know, any impact at all. You just can't say that. And besides which, it can't be done anyways. Nobody, you can never be insured for everything. And saying, "I want to be insured for the usual and customary stuff," that too is overly vague. So you're going to have to sit there and look, spend the time. You have to sit down with your agent or your producer, or the broker you're working with, and say, you need to walk me through what kind of hazards am I covered for? What kind of perils am I missing here? What are my options?" And a good example of that is taking it back in the context of the fires. I don't think people realize how many different sub coverages there are in a homeowner policy. I mean, we're all familiar with the fire limit, and we're all familiar with the personal property, and somewhat familiar with what's called additional living expense to pay for. If you can't live in your home or your condo or your apartment, you got to move somewhere else. How much coverage you have for that to cover new rent while you're waiting for your other place to be fixed. How much coverage you have, dollar-wise. How long will it last? Or whether or not you've got a really good policy that says, actual loss sustained.
Right.
But, you know, nobody knows that. And so you got to go over these things with them. And it doesn't end with the adjusted living expense or personal property or even scheduled, you know, your jewelry and fine art and whatever, your guitar collection, whatever it is. That's not all covered. You're going to have that, you know, appraised and seek additional coverage for that. But your agent, you know, you may not know that. And you've got to ask your agent about these things and force them to give you honest answers. If they misrepresent to you, that's a trigger to hold them ultimately to the highest standard of care. That's one of the ways that it can be done. But you've got to put it in writing as well, nicely and friendly, but keep everything documented. Because I teach the same thing to insurance brokers. Every time you give advice to your customer, unless you document it, it didn't happen. You don't want a word against word contest. That's a very common problem. And even now, I mean, I think my first article for insurance agents and brokers, for instance, was back in 1979. And it was called Document, Document, Document. And I wasn't the first. I mean, you know, I never would claim that. But there's so many of us that have been lecturing and publishing about one of the key things to do, not just for insurance brokers, but anybody providing a professional service, keep things documented. And this has been going on, you know, for almost 50 years. And it's like, it's amazing to me that still to this, at this very day, how badly documented things are. And there's no, especially with today's systems, computers, you know, it's so easy to do. You don't have to use a sheet in the file or a date and what you did and initials, you know, who did it. You know, you don't have to handwrite that stuff out anymore. You haven't had to do that for decades because of the computer systems out there. So it's amazing to me. But this is what consumers need to do. You got to force it out of your insurance producer to spend the time. And another recommendation I'll make at this point, whether it's timely or not, is never buy on price. Never. And we're programmed to do it. You see the advertising on TV every day. Oh, I just saved hundreds of dollars moving my insurance to this company or that company. Don't you? And then there's the placebo effect. When you finally your policy arrives and your insurance agent comes to you and says, here you are, Marcia. Here's your policy. You just saved $400 on a year. Aren't you happy? And you got that placebo effect. But the problem is you're not going to know whether or not you've given up anything or whether you're adequately insured in saving that money until you have a claim. And you know what? That's not when you want a surprise.
But how do you, as the non-expert in the field, know the questions you're supposed to ask then?
Well, that is the problem. So you have to be a little more gentle. Sit down with your agent, expect to play, you know, expect about an hour, and say, look, what do I need to know about this policy? What am I really covered for? What additional options are there? Can I increase coverage for water damage if there's a water leak? Because that's a nightmare these days. Or can I increase limits for what's called code and ordinance?
Say
I mean, if I've got a 75-year-old house.
Fred, I'm interrupting you.
Sure.
You said co-what?
Code. Building code and ordinance. It's called code
ordinance.
And ordinance coverage. And what those are building codes, basically. My house is 75 years old. You can imagine how different the building code for the city of Los Angeles today is compared to 1950.
Right.
So if I had a total loss fire and I get a quote for rebuilding my home to put it back in the position it was before the fire, how much of that cost is upgrading the house because of building code changes? And that's a separate line item in the policy.
I'm just speaking for myself personally. When my husband and I bought our home in 1973, it was a single story home. About the price of what of a car would be, a mild car today in this community of Westchester where I'm living. And then we added up and we increased obviously the size of our home and out. And I know that we had to update our policy to do that, but what I think you're bringing to light, Fred, and what I appreciate about your information is that perhaps those of us that are listening to you are going, you know, I just trusted my insurance agent to do what he's supposed to do. It's in my family trust. The house is covered, blah, blah, blah. But maybe it's not a bad idea to just revisit that with my agent and make sure that, gosh, you know, what does happen if my shower upstairs causes a leak and damages all my property down below my shower or something like that? Those are the kinds of things I believe you're talking about, right?
Yeah, that's part of it. No doubt about it. And well, and then on top of it, you know, you've got, you know, insurance companies are really getting nasty, on, especially with water losses, water damage losses like broken pipes. They're really getting difficult to deal with. And another problem is the software that they're using for rebuilding. I'm not going to mention names, but you can have that software come up with an estimate any way you want. You know, I'm semi-retired now, and I do expert witness work. And I've got a case where that's exactly what's going on. You've got one software report that says it's only going to cost $38,000 to repair. You got another version of the software printing out a report saying, no, it's going to be more like $68,000 to repair and replace.
Wow.
And replace. And so, you know, there's a big fight going on over that now. And that's very common. It's becoming more and more common. And, of course, the Department of Insurance is and the NAIC is sitting on its rear. They're supposed to be taking care. Their mission statement is to, you know, protect the consumer, and they're not doing it.
Wow. So what's the responsibility that these agents or brokers have to their clients? What is their responsibility?
Well, in essence, depending on where you are, their responsibility is to obtain the coverage you've ordered, you've requested. They have no duty to advise you. They have no duty to do anything. And they all, unless they hold themselves out as experts or specialists, or they misrepresent coverage, in some states, if they've been have a relationship with you that's more than 10 years, they can be held to a higher standard of care. And of course, if they misrepresent coverage to you, and they don't tell you what you need to know, is that misrepresentation? If they don't say anything, it depends on whether or not there's a question that you've asked, and they say, "I'm not going to answer that." That's the standard of care in 37 states, and unfortunately, California is one of the order taker states. It's, like I said, they have no more obligation to you to tell you what you need to know necessarily than the person who serves your breakfast at Denny's.
Damn. Well, so should we count on them for the correct guidance then?
In most instances, I say yeah, if they're willing to answer the questions.
Okay.
But you also have to understand that most people don't want to buy insurance to begin with. They see it as like a necessary evil. God, I hate going through this every year. I don't want to do it. And so they want to get it over with as quickly as possible. And unfortunately, that works to the advantage of the insurance company, not you. They hope you do that.
I didn't know that you could have a home without insurance.
You can't have a home without insurance if you have a mortgage loan. Lender is going to require it. Not the point. The point is whether or not you're going to get the information and guidance you need. And the answer in most states, probably not. And most people don't even ask. They want to buy cheap. And that's a problem, too, because believe me, I've seen even attorneys, knowledgeable, educated attorneys, underinsure their homes for that reason.
Wow. So what do you want our audience to know about liability insurance?
Oh, boy. Well, that's a whole different world as well. Because that's...
That's the version.
the idea is, you know, most people cannot afford to handle a lawsuit when somebody sues them for something. And so that's one of the reasons you buy insurance. And the concept, in essence, is to put you back in the position you were in before the loss. But again, people have unrealistic expectations about liability insurance and what your insurance company is going to do for you. Number one, you know, you got to be careful. As soon as you know about a lawsuit or are coming, or you've done something that you think is going to give a rise to a lawsuit, report it to your insurance company as soon as possible as an incident. Get them involved. The sooner the insurance company gets investigating the matter and can assess the situation, hopefully the matter will be quickly settled and everybody can go home. That is not always the case. And then again, you have to concern yourself with, in what capacity are you being sued? Are you a homeowner? Are you driving your personal automobile, you know, for personal purposes and get into an accident? or are you an employee of a business that has that's got a problem now? Because, you know, and then of course it depends on what kind of business you're in. Are you, as a business person or employed by a business, are you providing a service to others for a fee? Well, real estate agents do that. Insurance brokers do that. Lawyers, of course, do that. Accountants and architects and engineers, they all do that. And then you got a whole bunch of other people out there that are consultants of many kinds. They may be health consultants. They may be career consultants. They may be hosting, you know, blogs and doing interviews like you do. That's a media liability exposure. And then you've got all those professionals, degreed professionals out there. They all buy malpractice insurance. They all need general liability insurance to cover slip and falls in their office. They all need workers' comp. They probably need business property insurance as well. Whether they're renting a property or owning it, they have that need. And there's probably 15 or 16 other insurance policies they need. When I first got in this industry in 1975, you didn't need to worry about cyber liability. There was no such thing. Environmental liability hadn't become a big deal at that point in time. And arguably, it could be covered by a general liability or umbrella policy anyways back then. You didn't have to worry about employment practices for sexual harassment or wrongful termination suits. But that started in the late 70s and the early 80s. But coverage for it didn't appear until the 1990s. Business owners didn't have to worry about director and officer liability insurance, but they do now, even if they're not publicly traded. And a lot of these policies back then were written on what's called an occurrence basis, meaning the accident had to take place during the policy term, which made sense in many ways. Sure. Because, you know, when you have an accident, somebody may be immediately injured. They may not know to the extent how bad their injury is. That may take time to develop, but at least they know they're immediately injured and they're going to immediately do something about it. Go to doctor, run up medical bills, and get a lawyer if they feel so inclined. But that's not always true of professionals like architects. They commit a drafting error and they underestimated the weight load for a walking bridge over a freeway or over in the airport. They may not realize they miscalculated it until that thing collapses. And that could happen today, tomorrow, or 10 years later. And so to deal with that problem, the insurance industry came up with the idea. Actually, it's mentioned in the book I wrote that you mentioned, Claims Made Insurance Policy Changed the Industry. It was an underwriter at St. Paul Insurance Company at the time named Joe D'Alessandro, and he wrote the first Claims Made Policy. That the policy is triggered not by the date of the occurrence, not the date somebody's injured, or it's triggered by when the person who's injured makes a claim against you, the professional. And it made perfect sense because, like I said, an architect can make an error that's not discovered for 10, 15 years. An attorney may make an error in drafting your will. Well, no one's going to know that until the person's dead. And that could be, unfortunately, today, or it could be 25, 30, 40 years from now. And so from an actuary standpoint, from an analysis standpoint on how you do pricing, it actually made a lot of sense because claims-made policies, supposedly, when the policy year is over, you're done. If there's no claims made during that policy year, the theory was you can close the books on it and you know exactly how much money you made. And from an actuary standpoint, that helped actuaries a lot do better guessing on how they could predict the future based on what's happened in the past. And so that affected pricing. And so in the early days, you could buy an occurrence policy, but it was more expensive than a claims-made policy for that very reason.
Interesting.
And then claim-made policies evolved from there. From the early, my earliest policy in my library goes back to 1972. There's no comparison between that policy and the coverage language that you started seeing in the 1980s into the 1990s and even by today's standards. For instance, a lawyer's policy or an insurance broker's malpractice policy back in the 1970s probably had 5 exclusions. Now I've seen as many as 50.
So let me ask you've talked about your book, How Did the Claims Made Insurance Policy. So how did the Claims Made Insurance Policy change the industry?
Well, number of ways. Number one, it saved money up front, and so the policies were cheaper than occurrence policies. It made a lot of sense. It opened up the doors to be able to write coverage on a claims-made basis with some certainty that theoretically when the policy year ended, you knew exactly where you stood. Profit-wise, how many claims did you have or how many of them are still open? You know, how much do you think you're going to be paying out to settle them, what have you? And so it aided in that manner. And it made things life easier for everybody, including policyholders. And here's the reason why it was good for policyholders. Which you, as an attorney with an occurrence policy, number one, you'd have to keep 40 or 50 years worth of policies on file, you know, until you could scan them, I suppose, and keep them digitally. But you'd have to keep them on file so you know who to call in the event of a claim. Hopefully, that insurance company's still around. That's number one. Number two, think about the evidence you'd have to store. Your file materials, you could never throw them away.
Wow. That's a lot to think about. Let's go back to definition for something that I'd like to ask you about. Why don't you define for us what the definition of a claim actually means? What does a claim mean?
Oh, my God. Bingo.
Well, but that's a good question for us to understand because you're the expert, my friend.
Well, originally, as my book documents, you can timeline it, actually. But when the first claims made policies were written, the word claim, which is also very ambiguous. I'm going to make a claim under my insurance policy. Somebody's making a claim against me, you know, that sort of thing. It's a very ambiguously used word, much like agent and broker is.
Yes.
But the bottom line was the word wasn't defined in most insurance policies until the early 1980s. So that left it up to the courts to decide, okay, we'll decide what a claim is. And the courts started ruling that it's a demand for money or services. You're asking somebody to do something. Okay, that's a claim. That's the definition. And believe me, it had its problems. But that's how that evolved. Finally, insurance companies decided, you know, maybe we should define it. And to say it got worse from there is to be kind. I've probably seen 25 or 30 definitions of claim. There's no consistency at all. I mean, it could be a demand for money or services. It could be a demand for money or services. It could be a lawsuit. It doesn't go on to say served or unserved. It just says a lawsuit. Or it could be a written demand letter. It could be the commencement of a governmental action, such as the employment development people are coming after you because you've discriminated against somebody. So any governmental proceeding or a grand jury could be a claim, whether you know about it or not. That's another problem. So all these different definitions gave rise to a multitude of problems because there was also no consistency.
I see.
And another problem was arising as well. And this is where I think so many people that have read my book, one of the things they love about it is I timeline it out. How the policy evolved and how it got more complicated. And one of the complications that came about was requiring that not only the claim be first made against you during the policy term, trigger the policy, you had to report it to the insurance company during the policy term as well. So that's at least two conditions now. And the reason for that was because, you know, somebody would sue you and you'd be served and you wouldn't tell your insurance company about it. Oh, they're just going to waste my deductible. They're going to settle. I'm going to fight this myself. And then you find out you're in trouble. The case isn't going very well. Your attorney doesn't know what he's doing or what have you. And so you finally turn it over to your insurance company 2 years later. And meanwhile, they've closed the books thinking, okay, well, Joe Smith hasn't had a claim, so we can close the books on him. And then they got, you know, a claim reported to them 2 years earlier. Hmm. And so the court started ruling that, well, okay, that's a violation of the condition in the policy. But we're going to rule that unless you, Mr. Insurance Company, can show you were prejudiced by that late notice, that you still have coverage. And prejudice means a different result would likely to have occurred, which is difficult to prove. So ultimately, they came up with what's called a claims made and reported form. So it means that not only must the claim be first made against you during the policy term, you got to tell the insurance company about it during the policy term. And that was legally enforced. All of a sudden, the prejudice argument went out the window because it's no longer a condition in the policy. It's part of the insuring agreement, and that's where they moved it to. But here was the problem with that. Many definitions of the word claim do not require the insured know about it. For instance,
really?
A lawsuit doesn't say a lawsuit served on the insured. A written demand letter, but it doesn't say a written demand letter received by an insured. Or the commencement of a governmental proceeding doesn't say that you've been notified of it. And so if it's a claims made a reported form, how do you report something you don't know about?
Wow. You would be notified immediately.
Of course. But what if you don't know?
Right, that's the whole problem. You don't know, right? Isn't that
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you a good example of it, and this is a true story. At least three times, and these were all ruled on, I believe, by either federal court or state courts, happened in New Jersey, New York, maybe Florida. I think there's one in Florida, so maybe it's four. And then, of course, the Ninth Circuit for California, federal court. And this was a situation where directors and officers were named in an indictment, and that's a governmental proceeding. So the policy's triggered right there. If a definition of claim includes a governmental proceeding, well, then a grand jury indictment certainly triggers that. But all the indictments were sealed. So the target of the indictments didn't know. So how do you report something to your insurance company you don't know about?
Right.
But the courts ruled, well, when it eventually got unsealed and the policy had already expired and then you got served, too bad. The policy was triggered upon the commencement of the governmental proceeding, whether you knew about it or not. Go figure that.
Oh, wow.
How do you justify that decision? But there are four of them. There are four of them. And so that's the problem. And so, you know, that's one of many problems that go on with depending on what the definition is. I've seen policies where there'll have be four definitions of the word claim, and two of them will use the word, you know, received by an insured or words to that effect, and the other two don't.
Interesting.
And so, you know, you haven't even gotten off the second page of the policy, and you're in the definition section, you look at the word claim, and say, oh my God, this is a claims made and reported policy, and none of the definitions require I know about a claim. That's, talk about a gotcha that'll get you.
Yeah, truly.
And these policies are literally being interpreted literally by the courts. If it's clear and unambiguous, no matter how outrageous it may be, they're going to enforce it. That's how conservative the courts have gotten now. And this has been going on for quite a while. And nobody's done anything about it. And so other than, you know, policyholders getting, you know, screwed. And believe me, it's not just, you know, small businesses and small policyholders. Major companies are getting burned on this too. So, you know, you might want to argue, oh yeah, it's just a supply side trying to mess around with the consumers and, you know, keep them at bay and not have to be accountable for anything. But just remember, you know, suppliers are consumers too.
True. That's a good point.
And they're getting burned big time.
So you've been quoted as saying that statistically, lawyers are the worst liability protection, and I'd be curious to know why you say that.
Well, because it's been statistically proven. Before my book, I did a big article for an organization called that was published by the International Risk Management Institute, and they've been around for a long time. I'm actually a senior technical advisor and have been since 1990. They publish some wonderful technical materials on all kinds of insurance. I mean, you name it, they've got something on it. And they came out with their professional liability manuals that was first released, I think, in 1990. And I was a senior technical advisor for that publication and still am. I do a lot of articles that they publish, and they published a rather lengthy article in 2023, I guess. And that was a result of having reviewed and analyzed and, you know, put into a spreadsheet kind of thing, 224 appellate decisions throughout the United States, looking at cases where denials of coverage had been upheld, usually for one of six reasons. We came up with six different categories of denial for denied on a claims-made problem basis. And we also broke it down statistically by type of insured, whether they were directors and officers, whether it was an employment practice kind of matter, or an employee benefit problem, because those are policies are written on a claims-made basis, or, you know, and obviously professional liability policies are, and what have you. And so type of all that stuff was tracked, type of coverage, type of policyholder, you know, insurance company name, you know, that sort of thing. And when we sorted it, you know, 224, we looked at the denials for late notice, for not or not disclosing a claim or not disclosing a potential claim, what I call the safety net. And of course, you know, prior notice or prior knowledge. And the worst offenders were law firms. 28% of 224 cases were from law firms. And the next highest category were directors and officers. And while this is somewhat speculative, I would imagine that when you're a director or an officer of a company and you get a D&O claim, and you, what do? You turn it over to your corporate attorney. And he may or may not ask you, oh, by the way, do you have D&O insurance? And so by the time they get around to notifying the insurance company, you'd be surprised how much time elapsed. Sometimes 8 or 9 months, sometimes over a year. And so now you violated the reporting requirements of the policy, because most policies require that claims be reported as soon as practicable, which means without unreasonable delay. So to me, that means immediately.
Right.
Don't delay.
Always would be. I wonder why it would be delayed.
Oh, so many reasons. Number one, people think, oh, my rates are immediately going to go up. Or, oh, my policy's about to renew. We'll wait until after renewal to tell them. Well, number one, now you're committing potential misrepresentation, because you're supposed to inform the insurance company of anything material. You probably already answered a question saying, no, we're not aware of anything, which may or may not be true at the time you signed it, but it's no longer true now when you got served. And you say, oh, we'll wait until the renewal goes by. Well, guess what, guy? You're going to have a claim denied.
So how can a professional avoid being sued for negligence?
Well, you can't, frankly. You can't. You can't stop somebody from suing you. What you can do, however, is not only maintain a high level of correspondence and information back and forth with your customer or client, but most importantly, document it. And, you know, diary important events. So it's on. You've got a diary date set up. I mean, the computer systems that most professionals have today have all this stuff built in. And it's just amazing to me that how underused it is, whether it's documenting in the notes or sending out a confirming letter or making a recommendation to somebody and then they say, no, I don't want to do it. Well, Christ's sake, document that you gave the advice. Document they said no. Give them another opportunity to change their mind, for crying out loud. It's so easy to do. And what little time that may take, you may think is a big deal. I got news for you. Dealing with a lawsuit for 2 or 3 years in your life is a lot more time consuming.
Yeah, I would imagine. So it almost seems obvious that you would be doing what you just said.
Oh, yeah. There used to be a saying, if you didn't write it down and document it, it didn't happen.
That makes sense to me. It does. And I'm not in your industry. I wanted to ask you, you're also often called to serve as an expert witness. And I'd like to have you tell us a little bit about those experiences serving as an expert witness.
Well, for number one, it gives me a reason to get up in the morning now that I'm somewhat retired. And so that's number one. Number two, I am very honest about my area of expertise. And if I don't think I have it, I won't take the case. Number two, you know, I'm not doing it for a living so much. You know, my wife and I were professionally employed and we've saved a lot. You know, I do a lot of savings. We took advantage of 401ks, et cetera. So, you know, we're okay financially. Do I need to work for money? Not really. but I don't work for free either. But so that's number one. But number two, I'm very careful about the cases I take. I'd like to think that there are a lot of experts that think like that. If you don't believe in the case, don't take it. But that's not always true. Some people take anything, and they're just going to do their best, and they may or may not be honest with the attorney hiring them and say, well, I don't think we can win this, but I know you need an expert. I'm happy to do my best that I can. I don't do that. If I don't like the case, I won't take it, period. And if it turns out that I haven't been told everything I needed to know, and then I find out more on my own or through, you know, reviewing the file materials and find out, oh, my God, this case is horrible. It's not at all what I was originally told. I reserve the right, and it's in my retainer agreement, I can withdraw from the case. And I have. There have been times I have done that.
Can you give an example of an interesting case that you testified on? I'd just be curious to know.
Oh, why? There's so many. I was involved in a case where a major developer, and I mean a big one, was being sued for construction defects as well as some environmental issues as well. And I have to hand it, they were suing their broker for not having supposedly provided the right coverage, which wasn't true. As a matter of fact, this was, like I said, a very large project. So you can imagine the towers of construction defect coverage they might need to have, and they did. They also had towers of environmental liability coverage as well, which means a tower meaning they had primary coverage and they needed excess because these limits were in the stratosphere, hundreds of millions. And but they had, like any other business, they had a general liability policy, which generally covers slip and falls and that sort of thing. And general liability policies do not cover environmental claims. They do not cover pollution claims. They don't cover construction defect claims. That's because there, like I said, there's like four categories of exclusions, and one of them is we're going to put an exclusion in this policy because there's another policy that does provide that coverage, which is why every liability policy has a workers' compensation exclusion except a workers' comp policy, because they have to be clear and concise about that. We don't cover this. Another policy does. So this was a case against their insurance broker because they had tendered this mess and asked that every insurance company be put on notice, and of course the GL carrier says, we don't cover this. And so they reserved their rights, but they didn't deny coverage. They reserved their rights. Well, you know, they sure just went ballistic over that. And there was no reason to, because they had coverage elsewhere.
You know, I'm thinking about where you and I live and what's going to be happening here in a couple of years. Actually, I guess it's 3 years. The Olympics are coming here. And they're going to be in all kinds of locations. And I'm just thinking, wow, what must insurance coverage be when you're in the Olympics? Does that play a part? Does the Olympics have or LAX or any of those things? Are those all part of this?
Well, it depends on what happens. If you're talking a mass terrorist kind of attack kind of thing, those kinds of things are excluded. No, if you're talking about a lot of people coming into Los Angeles area, that is certainly going to happen. And so what are we talking about? There's probably going to there may be or may not be an increase in frequency with, say, automobile claims, because some guy, you know, comes in from some state and he wants to come to the Olympics. He rents a car and doesn't pay attention, or he doesn't not familiar with our laws in California,
right,
and what have you. So, you know, that's a problem. On the other hand, you know, so many people, the last time the Olympics were in Los Angeles, I never saw traffic so nice. Everybody disappeared. Everybody left because they thought it was going to be a nightmare, and it wasn't. It was actually, oh, my God, this is great. So it's hard to tell. The venues themselves are going to have plenty of insurance for it.
That's what I was wondering about, the venues.
The venues already carry high towers of liability insurance for that purpose. They're going to have a lot of security out, hopefully. and you know, prevent, you know, people getting too drunk or, you know, slip and falls and the usual kind of thing. And hopefully the vendors are going to, you know, going to be under some scrutiny as well, because, you know, they're going to be providing goods and services to all the visitors coming in. And, you know, nobody wants, you know, hopefully they're smart enough to realize nobody wins in a lawsuit. Nobody.
Really?
Yeah, nobody. Attorneys get a lot of the settlement money, you know, and rightfully so. They got to earn a living too. Nobody's made, you know, it doesn't work out that way. You're so, if you've really been seriously injured, you're going to be really lucky if you get enough money not only to, you know, cover all your medical bills out of pocket that you had, but also replace your wages and your quality of life. One thing's for sure, you know, your lawyer's going to make money, and of course the people that, you know, or being held accountable, you know, it's not a good experience for them either.
True. So depends, when you, go ahead, sorry.
Well, it depends how big they are too. You know, small business could be, you know, go bankrupt. A major company can, you know, pass on the cost of litigation and the cost of their insurance to their customers.
True.
Absolutely. So, we certainly wouldn't want it to take away from the C-suite bonuses, would we?
Oh my goodness. So, as an expert witness, how did you approach guiding your professional clients?
Well, I don't necessarily guide them. Unless I may have some input, you know, with the attorney saying, you know, I see some other issues here you might want to think about. And sometimes that happens. And some attorneys have called me a game changer because of it. But that's because I know more about it, you know, sometimes than they do, especially if they're out of their league. I mean, I don't know many plaintiff attorneys that specialize in suing insurance agents or specialize in insuring or suing real estate agents and brokers, that sort of thing. Whereas you do have attorneys that specialize in suing doctors.
True.
So,
or hospitals, right?
Yeah, that's a whole different world. And fortunately, I don't have much to do with it professionally. I never have.
Okay.
So most of my experience and expertise is non-medical. As far as avoiding negligence, it depends on what kind of profession you're in. But, like, you know, if you're providing a service, like a real estate broker or insurance broker or other consultants, do your job, do well. Don't take on something that you don't feel comfortable with. And more importantly, make sure you document everything and the advice you're giving your client.
Sure. My daughter's in the construction industry. And I'm sure that there's a tremendous amount of insurance that must be involved in that.
Oh, absolutely. Owner, contractor, professional, and pollution coverage, you know, an OCIP policy, or there's one for there's one for contractors and there's one for developers, two different versions of that. And then, you know, specific project policies and construction wrap policies are done a wonderful job in eliminating a lot of litigation, because there used to be a time in a major construction project, everybody got sued, every subcontractor, even the guy that's putting in the wallpaper. Now, if the roof is leaking, why are you bringing in the guy doing the wallpaper? What does he have to do with the roof leaking, for crying out loud? But they sued everybody. And so there were policies ultimately that were developed that basically insured everybody on a project basis. And that was a godsend because it eliminated all the cross complaints. I remember there was one big lawsuit in San Francisco over a major construction defect problem. And they had to actually take over a conference center room to hold all the lawyers.
My goodness.
It was crazy.
Yeah. Oh, I bet you have tons of stories. And speaking about that, you mentioned earlier your trademark, the gotcha that'll get you, as it relates to education liability and special lines of insurance. That's a pretty catchy little phrase. Why do you use that? What does define that for us?
Well, that's because there are a lot of gotchas that'll get you, and I see them every single day.
Wow.
And so to me, I put these up on LinkedIn, and very soon it's going to be in a book on listing out all the different gotchas to look out for in these insurance policies. Even today, there was a case that came down that was reported by a law firm Or this is where I get all my feeds and stuff. And involved in an exclusion buried in the policy that, you know, ended up allowing the insurance company to escape, you know, having to pay anything. And it was one of these things like, what are you talking about here? And it was pretty wild. And I really was shocked by it. And to the point where, you know, I haven't had a chance this morning yet to post it, but I'm going to do that later today. And, you know, it's fresh out of the news. But I'll give you a good example of yes. one that really happened about a year ago, and I'm still reeling over it. And that is the concept of excess insurance or umbrella coverage. And what that really means is a lot of people who are high net worth, for instance, they may not want a standard auto or homeowner policy with $300,000 in liability insurance. They want to have much higher limits. And that makes perfect sense. But so they may have towers of liability insurance that go into the millions in the stratosphere. Or maybe a corporation like Pharmacia Corp, a major pharmaceutical company, selling worldwide. You can imagine the towers of liability they have for product liability insurance or whatever. And it goes into, you know, maybe the $300, $400, $500 million level. Now, that means you're going to have many insurance companies each providing a layer. And those layers may be 10, 20, or 30 million each. So what happened to Pharmacia was this. They entered into a settlement for $207 million. Obviously, before they did that, they had to get permission from all their insurance companies because there are conditions in the policy that says, hey, don't settle with our money unless you get our permission first. And I would expect that. I have no problem with that. So before they could commit to this $207 million settlement, they had to go to all their excess insurers and say, are you okay with this? And they got back the answer saying yes. So they went ahead and finalized the settlement. So when it came time for everybody to pay their checks, it turns out the sixth layer, it turned out they were at the $160 million level. Said, we're not paying. And the reason given was because they had two conditions in their policy. The first one was one I would expect. All underlying insurers, all the insurance companies below us, had to have extinguished their limits. And so it's now our turn to pay, our turn to kick into the money. And that's fine. I would expect that. I have no problem with that language. It was after the word and. I'm still reeling over this a year later. It said that all underlying insurers had to have exhausted their limits and all underlying insurers, not the insured, mind you, not Pharmacia, their insurance companies had to admit liability.
Oh, boy.
Who admits liability in a settlement? No one.
No, you're going to lose.
And you're also, you know, you're putting that burden on the insurance companies who are tendering their limits. What do you think they're tendering their limits because they're not liable? But the court said, oh, no, they had to admit liability, and the court upheld that exclusion. And it turned out that wasn't the first time this insurance company had done that. They had done it before in 2012, and that was cited in the decision itself. And I was, like, flabbergasted because I've been getting feeds on the Internet a lot longer than 2010. So how come that case didn't get reported? But, you know, the funny thing was, right after that case came down, I got several emails and feeds, whatever, from law firms, you know, writing up their analysis and review of the case. And there was one in particular that stood out. And they said they analyzed the case, they accurately reported what happened and everything. And then there was a final sentence that I'm just mind blown over. And that final sentence was, it would behoove many insurance companies to hire knowledgeable coverage attorneys to help them draft language so they can avoid paying claims that normally would be paid.
What? Come on.
I'm not kidding.
Wow.
And that's not the first one. I've got four others on different cases where the lawyers are saying the same thing. We can help you write clever policies so you don't have to pay out as much as you used to pay. And we're not even talking gray area claims here. We're talking things that normally would be paid. We're going to help you write language so you don't have to. That's intentional.
Boy. Well,
and just today, as I mentioned, this law firm reported on a situation where there was a total collapse of a building, a total fire, totally destroyed, but they had an exclusion in the policy. They don't pay for raising the building. In other words, if the city says, okay, this has got to be cleaned up, where do you raise the building, tear it down, and start all over again, they had an exclusion for that. That exclusion was upheld.
That's amazing. Well,
so now they're not going to have to pay anything. This owner of this multi-million-dollar building is going to see nothing.
My goodness. Well, Fred, we've come to the top of the hour, and I could see where you are an expert. And there's a lot that you've said here. There's a lot of people that are going to go and buy your book. There's a lot of people like myself that is going to go and look at my policies and perhaps make an appointment with my insurance person just to make sure that everything is the way it's supposed to be. My house is in a trust. This will belong to my children someday. I want to make sure that everything is done properly. And I want to thank you for being that expert that has shared so much with us today. This has really been enlightening. And I want to thank you so much for joining me.
Well, it's my pleasure. And I do have one recommendation for people, even though my gotchas that'll get you is coming out. And I mean no offense, but I'm sure we've all seen the books called Such and Such for Dummies. It's quite
right.
A series. They have one called Insurance for Dummies, and I highly recommend that. That's one thing people can buy to help them with the kinds of insurance that is not claims made.
Terrific.
My book as well and Insurance for Dummies are both available on Amazon. Look them up.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's really exceptional advice. I want to thank you for spending this hour with me. I know we're neighbors. Maybe we'll meet one time and continue this conversation. But I just want to thank you for taking this time today to share your expertise with our listeners. I very much appreciate it, Fred.
I appreciate you hosting me, Marcia, because I when it comes to insurance, that's the fastest way sometimes to clear a room.
Well, hey, you didn't clear mine. All right, everybody, have a great rest of your day. Go out and get that book, and I'll make sure that you have that. Your website will be on my blog so people can easily find it. So I'm going to say goodbye for now, and thank you again so much for joining me.
Thank you. My pleasure.
My pleasure.